Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode is one I've been excited about for a long time, ever since I saw the notice of publication. Speaking with the author, Chris Miller, about his new book, Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology. You've probably heard about microchips more and more in the news cycle. Everything from the shortages last year that affected everything from Ford trucks to the production of phones and computers, and the increasing debate about how the United States should handle the fact that a vast majority of the world's microchips are produced in Taiwan, and therefore a possible conflict with China over the island could severely restrict and damage the world's supplies of microchip technologies. There's also a broader conversation following the passage of the CHIPS Act this summer, but whether or not the United States can bring back the production of microchips to the United States, despite the fact that while this industry originated here, we lost it over the course of a 40 or 50 year period that Chris and I will get into. With all that said, this is definitely something that's going to be heard about more and more over time, so I hope this deep dive is a great first introduction to the topic. Quick note, if you enjoyed this episode or anything else we've done recently, would love you to go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. If you go to that link, which is also in your show notes, you could get access to all of our bonus contents and, most importantly, from my perspective, support the show, help me for our production, and help us turn this into the best podcast we possibly can. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. Last but not least, this is also a great time to shout out our sponsor, Lincoln Network. This is the last call for Lincoln Network's Reboot Conference. There's also a link to that conference in Miami, which will go on next week on October 13th, as well too in the show notes. All that said, hope you all enjoy this episode. We'd love to hear what you think about this or any of our future topics. Chris Miller, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start with really basic definitions. What is a microchip?
So a chip is a piece usually of silicon that has lots of tiny circuits carved into it. And these circuits turn on or off, producing the ones or zeros that undergird all digital computing. And today, the most advanced chips can have billions of circuits carved into them. So making them is the most complicated engineering and manufacturing process that humanity has really undertaken. And without this ability to carve lots of circuits into chips, none of the computing we have today would be possible.
What's the difference between a microchip and a semiconductor? I've noticed that kind of in the discourse, they're used interchangeably, but I suspect it's not that simple, right?
Yeah, they are used interchangeably. Semiconductor really refers to the type of material out of which chips are made. So silicon is a semiconductor material. There are other more niche materials you can use. And a semiconductor material, it's not like a conductor, like a metal that conducts electricity, or like a insulator like glass that doesn't conduct electricity. It conducts electricity in certain circumstances. You can turn its conductivity on or off, which is why it's so useful for creating circuits that can be turned on or off.
So here's the question then. Are semiconductor materials, is that the part that's difficult, that's rare, that takes more effort, or it's the actual process that you input the semiconductors into, but so difficult?
Yeah, it's the process of making them that's tough. Silicon, for example, is just sand. There's a lot of silicon in the world. It's one of the most common elements in the Earth's crust. But carving circuits into silicon is extraordinarily complicated. And today, the most advanced chips will have billions, in some cases tens of billions, of tiny circuits carved into them, which is only possible because these circuits are tiny. The transistors in these circuits can be smaller than the size of coronavirus, a hundredth the size of a mitochondria. The manufacturing them is to put it mildly, an extraordinary challenge. And doing so by the billions is one of the most difficult manufacturing problems humans have ever faced.
Could you really demonstrate the breadth of uses / dependencies that we have when it comes to microchips then?
So chips are in almost everything today that has an on or off switch, and they are the way we produce computing power. So they're in your smartphone, they're in your computer, they're in data centers on which all of the internet runs, but they're also in all sorts of other devices that we don't normally think of as related to computing, from dishwashers to microwaves to cars. In many cases, will have dozens, if not hundreds, of semiconductors inside of them. Really, anything that that we touch today has a chip inside, and as a result, we're hugely dependent on them. Now, there's a lot of variation in terms of the complexity of the chips inside of goods. A dishwasher doesn't need that much computing power, whereas your smartphone does. And so the number of companies that can produce a chip for a dishwasher is pretty large, but the number of companies that can produce a chip in an iPhone, for example, is much smaller. And of the most advanced processor chips, 90% are produced by one company in Taiwan. And that produces a lot of efficiency, but also an extraordinary vulnerability in case something were to go wrong in the Taiwan Straits.
Something I'm wondering is why, and I'm thinking back to the experiences of listeners, semiconductors, chips really came into the discourse because there was a shortage of them last year. What drove that shortage and therefore like increasing the public awareness of this issue separate from just the Taiwan Strait issue?
So the shortage of the last couple of years is actually pretty interesting because there wasn't a supply problem. There was a demand problem. The number of chips that were produced in 2020 grew by 8%. And in 2021, it grew by double digit rates. We had more chips each year. The problem was that our demand for chips outstripped supply because we need more computing power and all sorts of devices, because there's more and more demand for high performance computing in data centers to enable artificial intelligence, because automobiles have more chips inside of them as they have autonomous driving features added to them. And so demand for chips is growing really tremendously, not just due to the fact that we're buying more stuff with chips in it, but the stuff we buy also have more chips in it. And so demand has outstripped supply for the past couple of years, and that created really costly shortages in 2020 and 2021 in the auto industry alone, for example, because there were many cars that simply couldn't be finished because they lacked a couple of chips. The cost was estimated to be $200 billion just for that industry alone. Across the economy, it was substantially larger. And that was an illustration, I think, of how dependent we've become on chips, and also of how bad it could be if the dependence on Taiwan, as you mentioned, were to go wrong and our access to Taiwan chips were to be cut off by a blockade or a war.
You know, I'm curious, the kind of description of your book on Amazon uses the well-worn idea that like chips are the new oil, which seems to be a little more accurate this case than people would say a few years ago that data, like on the internet, is the new oil, which it obviously can't be because data isn't worth anything. And also it's limitless by definition, hence you don't run into these different challenges. But with oil, at least there's a substitute, or at least a substitute we're working towards. Ideally, you could have electric vehicles, nuclear power powering the solar, all those different things. Is there an alternative to the chip, given our dependencies and the vulnerabilities of the supply chain?
Not really, and that's the problem. The alternative is to just have less computing power.
So the 1950s is the alternative. There is an alternative, but it's the 1950s.
Yeah, that's the issue, and because computing has driven economic growth in every sector of our economy, it's just not very attractive to imagine a world where we don't have access to the computing power that we come to rely on. It's certainly the case that if you were to imagine a world in which Taiwan disappeared tomorrow, would it be possible to still produce computers after some amount of time of adjustment? It would. But the capacity that we have to produce chips is so focused on Taiwan that the adjustment process would be enormously costly and take multiple years, if not entire decade. Right now, Taiwan, in addition to producing 90% of the most advanced chips, produces around one third of the overall computing power we add each year. And so rebuilding that capacity would just be a hugely complicated, time-consuming, and expensive process. The cost would be measured in the trillions of dollars once you consider the knock-on effects of all the other products that would be delayed or be simply impossible to produce.
Something I'm wondering about, you made reference to this in a previous podcast you appeared on, but you actually started working on this book in 2019, you pointed out, funnily enough, that back in 2019, a lot of folks, even in the foreign policy community, would think that this wouldn't be the most immediate or logical place to write a book on. Now, obviously, the book sells itself. Like, it's a very obvious topic that lots of folks, even beyond just the space that we work in, would be interested in. So what did you see in 2019 that made this a worthy successor project to your work on the Soviet and Russian economy?
Yeah, there are a couple of different streams that I realized were coming together, all of which were structured by the way the semiconductor industry works. One is that military technology has always been defined by access to the most advanced computer chips. And if you think forward to the next generation of defense technology, it'll be even more reliant on advanced chips. So think about autonomous systems, for example, or advanced electronic warfare systems. You need a lot of processing power, a lot of memory. A lot of signal processing capabilities, and that's all about semiconductors. So that was one. Two is that China today spends more money importing chips than it does importing oil. And if you want to understand the shape of the global economy, you've got to understand the semiconductors, because that's one of the biggest flows of global trade is actually chips. And the Chinese government has been in the midst of an almost decade-long campaign to try to wean it off its reliance on imported chips. But right now, they're really struggling to do so. And then third, because the Chinese are pouring so much money into trying to domesticate their own chip technology and in the process really wreaking havoc with the functioning of the market in the semiconductor industry, the US since the mid-2010s has been imposing ever tougher restrictions on China's ability to access chip making technology. And not only their ability to access US chip making technology, but also their ability to get chips manufactured in Taiwan or South Korea, because those countries are also only able to manufacture chips using US software, using US machine tools. So the US had this immense power over the industry, which seemed to me surprising, but in fact, is really crucial to understanding how the US-China tech competition is being structured.
And where are the actual chips themselves designed? Is this like with the iPhone, where it's designed in California, but it's built in China? Like, is there a separation between the manufacturing and the IP and design process?
Generally, there is. So generally, chips are designed by firms that specialize in chip design, and then they're produced by companies that specialize in fabricating chips. But if you look in the back of your iPhone, it'll say designed in California and produced and assembled in China. But what they don't tell you is that the chips inside of it can only be built in Taiwan. And that's the key, I think, to understanding the not only how iPhones are structured, but the way the tech industry is shaped today, because a lot of the hardware that we rely on, the chips in iPhones, chips in data centers, chips that make possible AI, are only possible to make in Taiwan. So yes, they're designed in California, but there's unique capabilities in Taiwan that you simply can't do in California or anywhere else.
You know, it's interesting. Everything that you're describing here illustrates how critical, not just to national security, but just your everyday way of life, a supply of chips is. You can, I think, in one way, say that this is a story of globalization gone wrong. We had this essential good, and we basically allowed it to be outsourced, and then we weren't focusing on the security vulnerabilities. Yet, interestingly enough, I think this was also pointed out in the podcast you'd appeared on, there have been plenty of Taiwan crises, even more intense during the 90s, 50s, 60s, could have been a nuclear conflict over it. Where did this sweet spot kind of emerge that this wouldn't have seemed to have been as much of a concern as it should have been, maybe?
Yeah, it's interesting about whether this is globalization gone wrong or globalization gone right. And yeah, you can make an argument for both. And so long as the Taiwan Straits are peaceful, it's going to be globalization gone right. And
yeah.
The risk, of course, is that they don't stay peaceful. If you ask why is it that the whole world has become so dependent on Taiwan, there are, I think, two key factors. One is that there's been immense consolidation in the industry, such that today there are really only three companies that are anywhere close to the cutting edge in producing processor chips. One is Intel in the US, one is South Korea's Samsung, and the final one is TSMC, the biggest Taiwanese company. And because there's been such consolidation, there's less competition, and it matters hugely which company is actually on top in terms of its technology. And TSMC has been growing in terms of its capacity and advancing forward in terms of its technological capabilities at a rate that neither Samsung nor Intel has been able to keep up with. So that's one trend. Second is that Intel, which used to be the biggest US chip maker and used to be the world leader in terms of technology, has really fallen behind over the past 5 years. And they're trying to turn things around right now. But until recently, it was easy for US policymakers to ignore the issue because they could claim with some justification that, yes, there was a lot of fabrication of chips in East Asia, but the technological leaders were still in the United States, pointing to Intel. Now that's no longer the case because Intel is in second or third place behind TSMC. And although it's still producing a lot of chips and the chips are still fairly advanced, they can't make the chips like on an iPhone. They don't make the chips that NVIDIA uses for AI and data centers. And in a lot of ways, they're really struggling right now. And the combination of the consolidation and TSMC's growth plus Intel falling behind was a real shock to, I think, the US tech ecosystem in general and US policymakers in particular, which is why they were all surprised when we sort of woke up in the end of the 2010s and all realized that actually the entire world's tech structure wouldn't function without Taiwanese-made chips.
Yeah, and this isn't quite a antitrust argument because there are obviously cases like, let's say, of social media companies where it doesn't make sense to have three Facebooks and search engines. There probably should, you don't need four or the fifth best Google. Is there a structural reason why the chip industry has consolidated, or is there nefarious practices, opportunities for lawmaking? How should we think about that?
I think it is mostly driven by good reasons. There's a huge return to scale in the chip industry because the more chips you produce, the more you learn about effective chip making processes and the more efficient you get. Which is one of the reasons why Taiwan's TSMC has done so well is as they've grown, they now produce more chips than Intel does. And as a result, they hone their processes and they get better manufacturing processes as a result. And in chip making, one of the key drivers of costs is the number of chips you produce that are effective. And it's really hard to produce effective chips because there's so much complicated manufacturing. And because TSMC has produced more chips than Intel, that's given them a leg up in terms of learning and therefore efficiency. So there's reasons why we should want scale in the industry. The problem is just where's that scale located and how geographically concentrated is it? And the problem right now is that it's not concentrated in New Zealand or in Switzerland. It's concentrated in Taiwan.
Something I'm curious about, because there's a tension, whether it's with the CHIPS Act or whether it's with these debates over like free markets versus industrial policy, like the story of the chip is inherently kind of tied into the connection between technology and government. So like, obviously I would love for you to recount the, like kind of the origins of Silicon Valley in this story, government purchases, going to the moon, and then TSMC is a project of the Taiwanese government. So can you talk about the tensions between those origins and just the need for markets to develop? Because another story, I'm going to throw on a bunch of stories for you to tell here. The Soviets tried to do this, you write about this, and they couldn't do it with their top-down approach without the big consumer market. And China's advantage is they actually do have a consumer market. So it's so complicated. So just kind of unpack that story.
Yeah, that's right. And the state versus market distinction is a really tricky one in the chip industry for the reason that you set out. The earliest chips emerged out of defense demands in the Cold War. The Pentagon needed better missile guidance computers, and so they wanted to shrink computing power. So the first major order for chips came for the Apollo spacecraft guidance computer, which guided the Apollo missions to the moon. And the second big order for chips was for the guidance computer on the intercontinental ballistic missile called the Minuteman II. So this was a industry that emerged out of defense procurement. Mm-hmm. There's been a deep relationship with the state from day one, but it's not the case that the government has been a panacea or has really driven technology in the long run. Because one of the key things that happened in the mid-1960s, right after these initial missile race and arms race purchases, was that chip companies realized that the defense market was a good market, but there's an even bigger market in civilian computers. And today, something around 98% of chips sold go to civilian purposes, not to military purposes. And that's precisely because chip firms were enough market-oriented to realize that, yes, it was great selling a small number of chips to the Defense Department, but they could really make money if they sold a lot of chips to civilians. And so finding the right balance between recognizing that the government is just inevitably involved in this industry, given the role the Defense Department plays, with the need to keep companies focused on the consumer market is really crucial. And, you know, as you said, in East Asia in particular, there's been a lot of governments playing big roles, sometimes productive, sometimes not productive in the chip industry. TSMC was a product of the Taiwanese Strait, and that's been a successful example. But there's been plenty of other examples, notably in China today, of governments getting very involved and the results being much less impressive in an economic sense. And so for the U.S. thinking right now about the CHIPS Act and industrial policy, I think there's a real careful balance that's got to be struck. On the one hand, I think we are too vulnerable on production focused in Taiwan, and there's a good national security reason to want to change that. But that doesn't mean we should have the government trying to rescue firms like Intel that are facing difficulties with their business model or otherwise trying to get more granularly involved into which firms win and which firms lose. And striking that balance is going to be tough because whenever you've got a large amount of government money being spent, there's always a lot of pressure from industry to put it towards the use of specific firms rather than structuring in a way where it shifts our reliance away from Taiwan, but otherwise leaves business decisions to the market.
Seems like, wouldn't the best way to do that be just to pay TSMC to build a fab here and not, and I guess the bad version would be, well, we couldn't work with TSMC because they're not an American company. We need to prioritize Intel, even though Intel is second rate. Is that kind of like that's the situation you want to avoid?
That's right.
So yeah, so please explain that.
Well, and that's actually one of the debates that was had during the CHIPS Act negotiation in Congress was, could the funds only go to US firms or could they go to foreign firms as well? And it's the resolution was that they're available to foreign firms that invest in the U.S. And so it's highly likely that TSMC will actually get some CHIPS Act funding for the facility they're bringing online in Arizona. And Samsung as well is opening a new facility in Texas, which will probably also get CHIPS Act funding too, along with Intel and probably a couple other U.S. firms. So in fact, we're doing that, which I think is the right decision. We're not going to solely bet on Intel or Samsung or TSMC. We're going to bet on all of them, which is a better investment strategy to have some diversification and let them compete amongst each other to figure out who actually produces the best next generation technology.
I wonder how much are the specific companies we're discussing stand-ins for their governments, right? Because sometimes if you're looking about the write-ups, they'll say Samsung and basically treat Samsung and the South Korean government as the same, TSMC and Taiwan. That's not true in the case of Intel and the US government for the debate. We wouldn't be having the debate you just pointed out if there was a direct tie there. So how much is this like national versus like TSMC is an independent company?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. It's on the one hand, TSMC is crucially important for Taiwan, and Samsung is crucially important for South Korea. I mean, if you look at Taiwan, around a third of their exports are semiconductors, and most of those are TSMC semiconductors. So you can't really disambiguate the future of the Taiwanese economy from the future of TSMC. And the same thing is true to a slightly lesser extent of South Korea and Samsung. So their governments are hugely involved in trying to help those companies. But both TSMC and Samsung are selling predominantly to open global markets. They're competing to get their products in consumer goods and in smartphones and computers that are sold openly worldwide. And so they're companies that have to compete on quality and compete on price. And so in that sense, although there is a lot of government support going for them, these aren't solely stand-ins for, say, the Taiwanese Ministry of Economic Development. There's a real company here that has an incredible track record, actually, of producing great technology at very good prices. And so I think we need to, on the one hand, be cognizant of the way in which both South Korea and Taiwan have supported their industries and how that has expanded the cost gap between manufacturing in the U.S. versus manufacturing abroad. But that doesn't mean we should treat TSMC or Samsung as illegitimate in any way, because in fact, they've been crucial to tech supply chains that the U.S. has benefited immensely from. And we are likely to be reliant on their production for many years in the future.
I'm curious. Obviously, the U.S. had a defense commitment to Taiwan prior to any 90% of the chips are, you know, sourced there. So it's clear that the defense relationship isn't purely based on the economic interest there. But what would happen if there were a conflict? I want to be very precise here because no one wants to make a military prediction. I just mean, And because I almost like imagine this, if there were a conflict, if the Chinese did conquer the island, would the factory be sabotaged? Would it be maintained? Would there be a quick flight out with the skilled laborers and engineers? Like, how do we conceptualize how that would specifically play out with TSMC?
If there were anything that involved fighting in Taiwan, I think it would be hard to imagine TSMC still operating after the fact. The machinery in a chip fab is among the most complex and precise machinery in use today. So it doesn't work well in war zones. You need, as you mentioned, all the personnel to be present. And if a small number of them left or sabotaged the operations, the whole facility wouldn't work. Chip fabs are full of explosive gases and toxic chemicals. You had to envision a facility that was hardest to take intact in a war, it would be a semiconductor production facility. And on top of that, TSMC's facilities only work because they have access to US software and US machine tools that are actually used to make the chip. So inside of TSMC's and Samsung's and every chip maker's production facilities are US based machine tools. And so you need those tools to work as well to make your chips. On top of that, you need to import regularly advanced and very pure chemicals and other types of materials that are used in chip making as well, which are largely imported from Japan, to some extent from Europe and the US. So even if, suppose hypothetically, China was able to take over TSMC's facilities intact and keep all the employees there and all the employees were willing to collaborate with the new Chinese government, it would still be pretty much impossible to operate the facility if the US and Japan wanted to make it difficult. So I don't think there's any world in which we need to worry about China actually taking over TSMC's capabilities intact. What I'm not sure about is whether Chinese leaders understand that. And there have been some worrying suggestions by analysts close to the Chinese government or employed by the Chinese government who have speculated that China could take over TSMC's facilities intact. And while I think they're wrong, if in fact that thinking is widespread in China, that makes things even more dangerous.
Yeah, something I'm wondering, as you're describing this, you may have answered this, but I want to get a very specific clip segment of this. The US originates this industry. There's talent, all of those Cold War drivers. But there's also, to your point, after the 70s, there's a huge consumer market here. Why did the industry shift away from just the US centricness of it? Labor costs? Is it as simple as that? Is that the origin story, really?
It's partly labor cost story, and there was offshoring from really the earliest days of the chip industry. In 1962, one of the two companies that invented the first chips, Fairchild Semiconductors, opened its first facility in Hong Kong just 3 years after inventing the chip. So this has been built in from day one of the industry, but it's not solely about labor costs, because a lot of the internationalization of the chip industry is not necessarily to low-wage countries. The Netherlands, for example, plays an irreplaceable role in the production of one of the types of tools you need to make chips. It had 100% market share in the production of these tools. Japan is another example. Japan doesn't have low labor costs, but it's a crucial supplier of chemicals and certain tools as well. And so part of the story is that making semiconductors is so expensive. A new fab can cost $20 billion. And making the machinery is so complex and so expensive that you really need the entire world's expertise, and you need a global market to fund it all. It's just difficult to imagine any country, even the US, having all of the expertise and materials inside of its borders. And that's why there's been a division of labor between Europe and the US and Japan, and then later on Taiwan and Korea to produce it, because it's just so brutally expensive to do every single part that you need to share the investment costs and share the R&D costs between companies in different countries. And that's also been a driver of the internationalization. And that's something we ought to welcome, so long as it doesn't conflict with security concerns. And it really didn't conflict with security concerns until quite recently, when China started trying to play a bigger role in the chip industry.
So one last question on this before I want to spend the last 15 on your broader work, especially related to Russia in the 20th century. I'm going to lay this out very simply, and I just want like your most direct answer. Pretend I'm just a politician. So, Chris, I've listened to everything you've said. Chips are important. We are far too dependent on Taiwan relative to obviously the national security risk. We have to make sure we continue the supply. What should we do so that over the course of the next decade, because this is an instant, it's expensive, like what should we do to get to the proper balance?
So step one, I think, is more credibly defend Taiwan to reduce the risk that China attacks. That's not a tech policy, but in fact, it's the most important thing you can do to guarantee security supply. Step number two, which the CHIPS Act is doing, is funding the fabrication of more semiconductors in the U.S., building more facilities that can do what's currently done on Taiwan, produce the chips we need in smartphones and data centers. And then three, which the CHIPS Act is also doing, is investing in the next generation of technologies to make sure that we keep our edge in the machine tools and the software and the chip design over China. Because one of the key advantages we have right now is that although we don't produce all of the chips, it's impossible to produce an advanced chip without US technology. And making sure that persists into the future is a key security goal as well as an economic goal for the US.
You know, and I wonder if this would make sense. If you were pointing out that it's a possible analytical flaw in the Chinese analysis that they could secure intact functioning factories, but would it make sense to, if we're debating ambiguity in regards to Taiwan, make explicit that factories would not survive any conflict?
You know, it's an interesting question. There have been a number of defense analysts who have suggested doing exactly that. I'm sure the Taiwanese might not like it if that one's made explicit, but I understand the signaling logic.
Yeah. So for the last 15, I'm really curious about this. I need to cite this podcast I keep referencing because it was a really good conversation, but you kind of pointed out when you were thinking about the questions in this book, you were thinking about how it was the Soviet Union was able to quickly turn, I mean, there's a degree of thievery and copying, et cetera, but they quickly turn around a nuclear bomb. They send the first satellite and first man into the moon. Yet at the same time, they totally miss computing. They can't build a chip industry. There's an interesting like ideological and economic debate there. So I'd be curious, two questions. So question one would be, what happened in the 20th century as regards to the US coming out ahead? And then two, if you were to be the technology czar with near unlimited power, how would you recommend that the United States like structure or make its decisions and able to basically win this next century?
Yeah, I love the question of what went right in the US to make the US the center of computing, because it is an interesting puzzle. On the one hand, you know, you might think that because chip making is capital intensive, pouring capital in the industry would be a crucial advantage, but it turns out that capital is important, but far from enough. You might think that having a lot of smart scientists is crucial, but it turns out that the Soviets had a lot of Nobel Prize winners too, including some Nobel Prize winners that won their Nobels in physics for semiconductor physics. But that was far from enough. You might think that having a spy apparatus focused on copying the best secrets would help. Soviets had that. That wasn't enough. In the earliest days, they had American defectors to the Soviet Union who had been spies working in their computing industry. Didn't make a difference. I think two things stand out to me. One is that although we focus a lot on the scientists and the engineers who solve the scientific problems that made the computing we take for granted possible, in fact, the science only gets you so far. And to turn something from a cool invention into a mass-produced product, you need a business model. And what's striking about the U.S. is the extent to which it was the easiest place in the world to turn an interesting idea into a business model. And that's what Silicon Valley did better than anywhere else. And that has to do with the availability of capital. It has to do with the institutions. It has to do with the fact that smart people from around the world were flocking there. And if you look at many of the people who founded the chip industry, they were from around the world, whether it's Andy Grove, one of the major leaders of Intel, who is a Hungarian emigre, or Morris Chang, who built Texas Instruments, was born in China. You can go on and on. So that's one thing, the importance of being able to turn smart ideas into viable businesses. The second, I think, is the extent to which having access to a global market and international supply chains was absolutely critical from day one. And I think the reference I made earlier to Fairchild Semiconductor opening their first facility in Hong Kong just 3 or 4 years after inventing the first chip is really important, because we think of offshoring as something that's happened recently. And in fact, it's been there from day one, and it's been crucial because you need efficiency, which means taking advantage of labor cost differentials. But you also need the ability to access the best materials and the best tools from worldwide. And although the US was the center of the global economy in many ways during certainly the second half of the 20th century, there was always purchasing of materials and machine tools from Europe and eventually from Japan and elsewhere. And the ability to access that was really important in enabling technological progress. And if you compare that to the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union had lots of capital investment guaranteed by the state and lots of people being trained in physics, but they couldn't access global markets either for customers or for suppliers. And that was a huge problem because their only trade partners were Bulgaria and Hungary. You know, no disrespect to the Central Europeans, but that's not nearly as attractive as being able to sell to all of Western Europe and all of and Japan and most of Asia during the period. So that was really crucial to the industry. And the globalization that we talk about as being something new, that was in fact always there and always important.
How do you think about thinking about this? Because today, you know, Russian President Putin gave his, you know, speech annexing parts of Eastern Ukraine. There's this big debate about sanctions and how, like, actually the Russians have severe microchip shortages, you know, taking things from like refrigerators and microwaves to bring them to the battlefield. How do you think about Russia's place in the global economy today in the context of everything we've just been talking about, but also just like the sanctions policy?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Russians have, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, let their already backwards chip industry decay further, such that today the Russians have a third tier chip industry, and even Russian military equipment relies on chips that are smuggled in from the US. And if you actually look at the missiles, for example, that have been shot into Ukraine, and the guided computers have been taken apart in the Russian missiles, they're full of US and Korean and Taiwanese made chips. So the most sensitive systems in Russia rely on our chips, which is a sign of how backwards they are. And the more difficult we make it for them to acquire this type of technology, the more their military is going to suffer. And ultimately, the harder it will be for them to keep up technologically.
What do you see when you think of the... I'd actually love for you to go back a bit to the chips section and focus on like the CHIPS Act itself. You know, we discussed some of the debates around it, but what actually came out of the legislation and what steps for improvement the next go around would you recommend?
So there were, I'd say, three main provisions in the CHIPS Act. One was to fund leading edge semiconductor manufacturing, so both logic and memory chips, which is where the bulk of the money is going to go. And that's for Intel and TSMC and Samsung to build new facilities in the US. And I think that's a pretty straightforward process. I think it's going to work. It's going to be expensive, but I think it's necessary. Two, there's a lot of focus in the legislation on chips for military uses, which are really unique in many cases. The military uses memory chips and processor chips like the rest of us. They also have unique demands for radiation hardening, for example, in certain chips, or unique temperature demands that chips operate in ultra cold or ultra hot environments, as well as chips that are designed for unique purposes, certain types of communication, for example. And the effect of this is that the Pentagon has a lot of difficulty managing its chip supply chain because they can't simply go to Intel or go to another big chip maker and buy off the shelf chips for what they need. And so there's a lot of money now going into helping the Pentagon secure the specific types of chips that they require. And there's a unique difficulty there, which is that for certain types of chips that require the most advanced processes, the US and every advanced military in the world must now turn to Taiwan. And so one question is, how do you ensure the security of the chips themselves, make sure they haven't been tampered with, for example, when you're buying them offshore? And that is an area where a lot of research is happening right now. And it's quite important for the future, because so long as we're going to be dependent on international supply chains, which is for the foreseeable future, we want special mechanisms to make sure we know a chip will operate the way it's supposed to operate and has been tampered with. So that's the second main focus, is defense supply chains. And then the third is R&D into the future. And this is where I think really pretty optimistic, is that a large chunk of the money in the CHIPS Act is going towards R&D. And this is what's crucial, because ultimately the question of where you build chips is important today, but the future is going to be determined by which countries have the best technology. And the US has a really good track record of not betting on specific companies, but in putting money into the R&D ecosystem and letting our companies find out what the best products are to commercialize. And the fact that we're doing more on that front, I think, is a positive thing. And I'm optimistic about where the results will be when we see them being materialized in a couple of years' time.
Is there any room for disruption or startups? It's kind of ironic that Silicon Valley's origins lay in this space, yet our entire conversation is about big, seemingly undisruptible companies, because this seems a very like industrial era technology, just given the advantages of scale. How should we think about that part?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. On the one hand, the US might not want disruption, because a lot of the choke points are in our hands. And one of the things that lets the US control the way the global chip industry is structured is that there are a small number of companies with really deep moats around them, especially these machine tool makers that make the tools that make chips. And so it's in our interest in some ways that these firms can't get disrupted. And so there's an interesting kind of national security versus economic debate at play here as to which we ought to be pushing for. We want them to move forward, but we don't want severe challenges to the business model, especially if those challenges come from other companies. But on the from the perspective of chip design, which is where a lot of the innovation is taking place, there's a lot of scope for disruption. And we've seen over the past half decade more money going into chip design startups than at any point in recent years. And this is driven largely by new interest in AI and in optimizing semiconductors for certain types of AI workloads. And here, the startup costs are lower. It doesn't cost $20 billion to build a new production facility, but a lot less to create a chip design startup. But even still, the costs are quite high, because if you want TSMC to produce some test chips for you, you know, you've got to be potentially big enough to attract their interest. And so there's actually some, I think, useful provisions in the CHIPS Act to reduce the cost of prototyping and test runs for new startups, so they can get access to manufacturing earlier on and make it easier for chip design startups to actually prototype their products and see if they work. And so there's actually a history of DARPA doing this in the US in the 70s and 80s, of trying to open up access to manufacturing services, which are always expensive, to chip design startups. And the fact that we're doing this again, I think, is an important way to boost innovation in the chip design sector, where we definitely want it and need it for AI. And it will benefit, I think, firms in the manufacturing side of the system as well, because ultimately they succeed when we have US-based chip designers that are optimizing around their processes.
So let's wrap with this question. We've focused on the US, Taiwan, South Korea, Russia. How does the Chinese side of this, especially the more competitive side, work? Asia Pacific defense issues aside, like, how does the actual Chinese market look? Is there a main Chinese company? Like, what does that side of the table look like?
Yeah, it's been changing a lot in the past couple of years as the Chinese government's become a more central player. 15 years ago, the Chinese government was involved in semiconductors for its own defense ecosystem, but it was really a kind of a small player relative to firms that were genuinely private and internationally focused. And the biggest Chinese chip maker, SMIC, was actually founded as a private firm with investment from Goldman Sachs, for example, and Toshiba, the big Japanese tech firm. But over time, as the Chinese government has gotten more involved, it's moved into the state's orbit much more dramatically. And so there are fewer and fewer firms that are big in China that are really at all privately oriented, even when they're privately owned, and more they're responsive to the subsidies and to the demands of the Chinese state. And a key question going forward is going to be, to what extent does China begin to pressure or mandate that Chinese firms buy China-made chips, versus buying chips from the rest of the world. Because right now, if you're at Tencent or an Alibaba, one of the big Chinese tech firms, you're mostly relying on chips imported from abroad, which is why China spends more money importing chips than it does importing oil. Chips made in the US or in Taiwan or in South Korea. But there's a possibility that China moves in the direction of requiring more Chinese firms to buy Chinese chips. And if so, that would really reshape the balance of trade. It would also potentially set back Chinese tech firms if they're forced to buy lower quality chips at higher prices. So it's an interesting policy choice for the Chinese, but how far they want to go in the direction of state control versus right now, they've got a balance between having some firms that are mostly private with state influence, obviously, versus the trend of more state control, state subsidies, and ultimately even more kind of direct military influence as the Chinese government tries to prepare itself for the ability, at least, to maintain self-sufficiency if it needs it in time of war.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. My real takeaway from the book in this conversation is just that there's no deglobalization. There's no pure globalization. There's no pure state. There's no pure market. All like policymakers, business leaders, everyone's kind of have to find that right in between mode. And that's a huge part of the question over the next decade. Chris, this has been incredibly helpful. The book is out today, Data Publication, and would be great for you just to shout out the actual title. Folks like it when the author themselves does it. Thanks for coming.
Great. Well, thanks so much. The book is Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology. Thanks for having me, Martha.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.